find it. Okay. Wait a minute.
Well, when Merle first got up here, of course, she came up in 62, was it, or 61, and accepted a job teaching in the high school.
So did you meet up here?
No, we met.
Oh, okay.
She was taking her master's degree at Colorado A&M, Colorado Aggies, and in home economics. And so we had corresponded from Kodiak, and it was a natural come up, teach school, and you see how you like Alaska, and then we can get to know each other better. And
oh boy, where have we heard this before?
So, what was I going to say? She came to Kodiak. And of course, one of the first things she did is went around town taking a bunch of pictures. Mm-hmm. And I was always taking pictures. Well, and after the tidal wave, it just seemed like a natural to go and take some pictures of the devastation caused by the tidal wave. And it also seemed like an obvious thing is, let's get out some of the photographs we took a couple of years ago, and we'll go back and try to stand in the exact same spot and take a picture so you can show what happened, you know, what effect it had. And so that's what we tried to do, so anybody could look at the picture and see it was taken from the same place, and you could see the devastation that occurred, you know, in a matter of minutes. So that's what we did, and it worked out real well.
Yeah, those are good pictures, guys. Every time we're up there, we stop and look at those. You guys did a really good job on those.
Little deal there, just a minute.
This?
That, yeah, when you want to record experiences, my experience in Kodiak, what Kodiak was like in the past.
Obviously, being a resident here for a long time, you've seen a number of changes.
How it differs from today.
Right.
What these people were doing during the earlier years. What was going on in Kodiak at the time, how events affected Kodiak and their own lives. Well, in order to do that, my first thought would be you'd have to have the ability to do that. In other words, to be able to comprehend, and I have a tendency to, you know, I accept things as they come, and I could say, well, you know, they really weren't that different, when in fact they were tremendously different.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
To some extent. But one thing I thought of that I think is significant was that whenever one of the governors would come to Kodiak, and I can remember he was United States Senator Ernest Greening.
Oh yeah, uh-huh.
Okay, Senator Ernest Greening. Actually, I don't think he was ever governor, was he? It was Governor Bill Egan. But occasionally these men would come to town,
uh-huh.
Come to Kodiak. And in the early years, when I say early years, when in the 50s,
uh-huh.
There's no doubt about it, the bars were probably in the evening, people would go to the bars and they'd drink and they would dance and they would eat. And before Merle and I were married, we always went to what they call the 49 room. That was in the Mecca bar. And we would have a steak sandwich, and it was a great big beautiful New York steak for $3. With a baked potato and a salad, and Ray Wilson would cook. And I think what they did is they just practically gave away that beautiful steak dinner just to get you to come there.
Mm-hmm.
And then most people, I guess, would stick around and do some drinking, and then that's where they would make their money. But the bars, you could walk in any bar any time and people would, you know, call you by your first name. In fact, I can remember saying that the bars were much more friendly than the churches.
Yeah.
Because they call you by the first name and, you know, you always have this carefree attitude and happy-go-lucky. And but of course, there were a lot of lives ruined in the bars as well. But at any rate, getting back to Governor Egan, for example, I remember walking in, I don't know whether Merle was with me or not, but I was in the Mecca Bar, 49 room, and there's Governor Bill Egan sitting there at the bar. And I would just go up and sit down next to him and say, "Hi, Bill."
You're kidding.
And here's the governor of the state of Alaska. Well, he came to Kodiak. I guess he must have talked to the chamber or visited with some fishermen or something. But that night he was by himself and he just went down and of course, because King Crab was growing in importance, and because it wasn't, the more a person like, you know, the governor or any politician knew about a major resource, I think that enabled that particular person to make more intelligent decisions. But it was common. I can remember Ernest Gruning. What an incredible guy he was. I bumped into him in the Anchorage airport, and he walked up and said, "Hello, Guy." He was incredible, incredible. But all the governors, and when I say all of them, maybe I can't even think who it was besides Bill Egan. Of course, Jay Hammond, I knew Jay personally. And the last time I saw him was up in Lake Clark, and when he saw me, he said, "Oh, I can't believe it." He said, "I thought you were dead. Somebody told me you got killed." But
you don't expect that a governor, you know, that you would have access like that or that sort of familiarity with your governor. But then again, there weren't many people in this state.
Well, that's it. That's it. And I can remember I wrote him a letter and urged him to throw his hat in the ring. That's just how I worded it. To get involved and run for governor.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote me back. I still have the letter. It'd be neat to dig it out.
Oh, do you?
And he thanked me for the letter and for the confidence, and I think he was seriously considering it. He hadn't decided by that time, as I recall. And then he called me one time, I remember, and asked me for a recommendation for a person. And I didn't recommend the person. And the person ended up getting hired anyhow.
Oh, really? A person on his staff, you mean?
Well, no, there was a person that I guess he was considering appointing to a position.
Oh.
But, so anyhow, that I think was unusual. And I think, you know, in Kodiak, working with Fish and Game Department, working on commercial fisheries, I probably didn't realize it at the time, but I had a real important job, and so as months and years went by, I, you know, learned more and more about all the aspects of the fishery, and so it's just natural that people would look me up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and talk to me.
And you were the only one in the state at the time? I think when I listened to the tape, initially, when you came up, weren't you one of the few biologists in the state, or the only one in the state?
Well, I think I might have been the only king crab research biologist.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, your little community scattered around, like Ketchikan, Sitka, Cordova, Homer, each one of those communities probably had one biologist working on everything.
Oh, okay.
So it was a little unusual to have a biologist just working on king crab. And then Senator Al Owen lived in Kodiak, and he was incredible. He was really incredible. Every time he'd come back from a trip, he'd come in my office and give me all the information that he collected during his travels on king crab that he might have gotten from Japanese or Russians or, of course, there wasn't much, but he was involved with, I think, some of the treaties, getting together with people from other countries, you know. I think he was working on some of the salmon treaties. And so he would meet with some of the scientists from the other countries. So he was really a neat guy, Senator Al Owen. And I think he raised his family for quite a few years on Marmot Island, which is about 30 miles from here, maybe, out in the middle of the ocean. And I can remember just experiences. Of course, I did have a chance to go to China and Japan and Korea. That was later on, and it wasn't an experience in Alaska, but...
What was that for?
It was people to people. It was organized, I think, by President Dwight Eisenhower. And I think what he did was he noticed that when people from different countries get together, it's always presidents and diplomats. And it occurred to him that it would be real important if common people could get together and spend time with one another. And so he started this people to people. For example, you'd get medical doctors from the United States and they'd travel to other countries, whether maybe they're heart surgeons, maybe they're into brain surgery, whatever it is. Of course, I was a fishery scientist, and so I traveled with a group of, I think there were maybe 40 of us, from the United States, all involved with fisheries. And then tours would be set up where we'd go and we'd visit fish hatcheries and we'd visit aquaculture facilities. We'd go to universities and meet with the Japanese or the Chinese or the Koreans. We'd go to their canneries and their fish markets.
Oh, neat. Were you able to bring back anything from that trip that you could use here in any of your research, or that helped influence any of your research here?
Well, on one trip, not really a great deal. If you get into China, you know, you learn that what they're involved with, their major fisheries are aquaculture, and they're raising carp in ponds. For example, in Japan, they're raising eels, and there wasn't a great deal, except in Japan, that was being done on shellfish, on invertebrates, which was my specialty. And then I'm just trying to think in terms of how Kodiak might have been different in the earlier days. It was so much smaller. There were almost no roads paved whatsoever.
Yeah, where was the road? Was it just down in town? Right down.
It's changed so much because of after the tidal wave and the earthquake and urban renewal, it changed so much. About the only way to really get a get a handle on is to look at old photographs. And of course, that's something. Did we talk about that the other day?
Well, we started talk about that a little bit.
But we took a lot of pictures in the late 50s, and then after the tidal wave, when we saw the tremendous change that took place. And even now today, I could go downtown and I could take some pictures in 1994 and select the location where I'd stand. Now, we have a bridge going to Near Island. Well, we didn't have that bridge. And well, they just started building it. The initial stages where they poured a couple of the concrete pillars. I got up on the hillside in the particular spot that seemed to be ideal and started snapping some pictures, thinking that when that bridge is finished, I'm going to go back and take some pictures after it's finished. And I've never done that yet. But I could easily go back and take some pictures today and have some really neat before and afters.
Definitely.
But I used to take Tracy and Wendy, my two little daughters, or their girlfriend, Jean Ann Soppy, used to go over there. And what I would do is I'd take my skiff and I'd take them over to Near Island. So just across the channel, you know, what's it take, 3 minutes to get over there? And I'd let them off and they'd have a lunch and they'd have maybe a couple apples or something because they wanted to feed the... There was some ponies over there that Tommy Gallagher had.
Oh, really? He kept them over there?
And I'd say, okay, they'd have a watch, and I'd say, be back here in, you know, 4 hours at 3 o'clock or whatever. And those girls would just go over there, and that would be their island. They'd be the only human beings on the island, and they'd just wander all around.
What a neat way to grow up.
Oh, yeah, and it kind of really broke your heart to see the bridge and then see all the building of roads and boat harbors.
Now, does Kodiak look very developed to you?
Very developed?
Yeah, does it feel congested to you? Does it look overdeveloped? Well, you mentioned the island, the bridge going over to the island.
Well, it's obvious a little tiny town, but compared to what it was in the 50s, it's this big city,
yeah,
you know, by comparison.
Well, he keeps telling me how safe it is and the house can remain unlocked and this can be in the car unlocked. And, you know, I said, I think you're living in a dream world of what Kodiak is. I think Kodiak has crime and Kodiak has many things in the big city that you think it doesn't. And I think he's sort of living in the past too, with his mentality of Kodiak being that small, sleepy kind of town.
Well, of course it is small and sleepy. The fact that it's a seaport, you know, in any month, you can have 1,000 boats pull up to the dock with men from all over the world. I mean, you have sailboats coming in here. That maybe the last port of call was England, as far as that goes. But, you know, I just thought of, what I'm trying to do is think of experiences that were unusual. And my wife's not here, so I can tell this one, I guess.
Well, we'll clear it with her before it goes on tape.
I had a girlfriend that, I don't know how I came to meet her, get to know her, but she lived in Cordova.
Now, this is prior to Merle.
Oh, yeah, sure, I was single.
Okay.
And she lived in Cordova. She was born and raised in Seldovia. So I had made arrangements to fly to Cordova to see her on a weekend. And so I flew to Cordova. Good night, I can remember. It's like an O. Henry story. I just remembered she had been married before and divorced, and her husband was a pretty famous painter, an artist. But anyhow, I was in Cordova, and when I called her, she says, "Oh, I didn't expect you this early." She says, "I have a date tonight." Can you imagine? Gee, man, I feel like shooting myself. She's got a date. So I went downtown in one of the bars, and I'm sitting at the bar, and I had a glass of beer, I guess. And the guy that was on, waiting on the bar, just in a conversation, there was this beautiful picture on the wall of a, it's in black velvet. And it was, a real good taste. It was a nude painted on black velvet. And I just asked the guy about it. Come to find out he'd painted it. Good night. You know what that meant? This guy was this gal's ex-husband. And I just walk in and there he is. Okay, well, so later that night, it might have been 12 o'clock, and in Cordova, all the sidewalks were made of wood. They were just boardwalks.
Oh, really? Sweet.
And I was walking down the boardwalk, feeling sorry for myself, I guess, and I noticed this guy walking toward me, and he was looking at me weird. You know, I just had that feeling, what's he looking at me for? And as we approached each other, we kind of walked slower and slower, and pretty soon we're face to face staring at each other. And he said, gee, man, I know you from somewhere. Where are you from? I said, I live in Kodiak. Where do you work? He says, I'm an engineer with the oil company. I'm a petroleum engineer. Phew, I don't know any petroleum engineers. And we kept talking, and, well, what do you do there in Kodiak? I said, I'm a biologist. Oh, I can't believe it. You're the guy. He says, all night long, my date just kept telling me about this scuba diving biologist in Kodiak, Alaska. Well, it turned out the guy had, I think he had a bleeding ulcer. He was really in misery, had a terrible evening, and I was so happy that this guy had a terrible evening, right? Well, then we kept talking to find out he was my best buddy in Colorado.
What? This man was your best buddy in Colorado?
Was my best buddy in Colorado when we used to eat liver and onions practically every night of the week because that's the cheapest thing you could eat. We'd go to the cafe. Rodney Krantz.
Wait a minute, guy. How many years after your college was this?
Well,
this wasn't that this was long?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. When I say my best buddy, when I went to Rutgers, I mean when I went to Colorado State University,
right.
I didn't know anybody.
Right.
I was plunked down on a campus with thousands of people. And I knew no one, and it just so happened we always went to the same cafe. He was always there, and we'd always sit at the same table.
Okay.
And he was just a neat guy, and we just spent a lot of time talking. But I didn't recognize him dressed up in a parka walking on a boardwalk in Cordova at 12 o'clock at night. So we say, hey, well, let's go inside. It's too cold out here. So we go walking in the bar. Well, here's this guy, tending bar, the same guy, his ex-husband.
Painter.
Well, this Rodney had just been in there having dinner with his date, who was this guy's first wife.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then he saw me come in the night before by myself. Then he sees me coming in with this
him.
Guy.
Right.
Well, the next night was my time for a date.
Right.
And so I came in there, too, with her. And so you can just imagine. In a tiny, small, little town like that.
Wow.
But it could have been an O. Henry story. So what's the chances of a good friend of mine from Colorado ending up in an Alaska?
Know.
That was just incredible.
I know. Wow.
And the flying from Kodiak, we had an airlines called PNA, Pacific Northern Airlines. We called it practically no airlines. And the terminal was just a little tiny. It seemed like it was a 10 by 20 10-by-20 building. And if you wanted to get to Anchorage, you had to go to Homer and land. And when they opened the door, they left it open for cargo, and you could freeze to death in that plane. Then you would land in Kenai and then Homer. And on the way back to Kodiak, you'd have to land in Kenai and Homer.
Wow.
It's the only way you could do it.
So once you were here, you were basically here. You didn't travel too much once you hit Kodiak.
Well, no, there was no ferry or anything. Yeah. But Red Dodge, I can remember, he was one of the pilots. And if you lived here, you got to know everybody, and you got to know them well. And I can remember that one time we flew to Anchorage, and I was the only guy in the plane, except the pilot and the stewardess. And so, you know, we flew about 500 feet over to Barren Islands looking at sea lions.
Oh, did you really?
With that commercial airplane.
Uh-huh.
DC, was it DC-6 or whatever it was?
And just the three of you on it.
That's right. But of course, if you knew Red Dodge, he was just a total character. And I can remember probably in the 50s, I helped out a guy named Cal Lincecum. He was studying sea lions. So we flew to Marmot Island. And it's pretty tough getting in there. We flew into this little lake. Chuck Weir flew us into the... What the heck did he fly us in there with it? But it doesn't matter. It seemed like it must have been a float plane. So we spent about a week on the island. I took my dog and climbed up in the cliffs and were studying these sea lions. They had tagged a lot of them at the Barren Islands, and they were trying to find out if these tagged animals were showing up on Marmot Island.
Now, excuse me, you were just doing this for your own personal...
Well, no, I worked for Fish and Game, and Cal Lincecum worked for Fish and Game.
Uh-huh.
And I was just helping him out.
Oh, okay.
Keeping him company and helping him carry stuff. But the only reason I mention it is we got stranded there. The wind came up, and it seemed like a week went by, and we couldn't get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally Chuck would fly over and then just look over the situation and just leave. And I can remember the only thing we had to eat for several days was salmon berries.
Really?
And I can remember we found it was an old broken down cabin, and in the cabin was a jar, and it had about 100 beans in it. And the lid, the tin lid of the jar, inside the cabin had rusted. And all the rust, you could look right down through the rusted lid. It was just a big hole in it. But all that rusty lid had fallen down on the beans. So we poured out the beans and cleaned them up a little bit and then boiled them. And it seemed to me we boiled them for an hour, and they were still as hard as rocks. And then we found a dead ground squirrel, and we tried to cook that thing. It was all dehydrated, you know, it was hair, and figured maybe my dog would eat that. But Chuck flew over us one day. He flew over the beach out. The lake was close to the beach. And he flew over and made a quick circle and dropped us a package, and we were really excited, you know. We figured dropped us T-bone steaks or something.
Mm-hmm.
We ran over there. He dropped us 4 rolls of toilet paper. And that is a fact. I think he's still alive today, and I think he flies.
So.
Push your thing a minute.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I just thought of something else that I think is maybe worth talking about. Before I came to Alaska, I had learned how to scuba dive. Well, in Rutgers, I was on the swimming team. I was a springboard diver, but as a kid growing up in New Jersey, it was so hot in the summer, we just would always go down to the Musquapsink River and swim in the river, and or we'd go to Pine Lakes, you know, and climb over the fence and jip in. And but it seemed like when we were swimming, we always were under the water looking at things. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like it was any fun just swimming on the surface. And then when I got to Rutgers, during spring break, we went down to Florida. And in those days, you could just get scuba gear and rent a skiff and go out, and you didn't have to have a license or know what you're doing or anything. I don't know how we ever ended up without killing ourselves. And so when I got to Kodiak, it seemed like it was a natural for studying the king crab. And so I got scuba gear gradually. And I almost think the department was buying some scuba gear for me. And they, quite shortly after that, they required that I go out and take a course so I can actually verify and document that I know what I'm doing, so that protects them.
Right, I noticed also they required that of you, because I read in that thing that you were one of the few people that went out and documented your research with photographs.
Okay, that came a lot later. But
beautiful pictures.
Initially, I would just do a lot of diving, and it just seemed, you know, if you can go down the bottom of the bay and swim around and see the crabs, and that you just so much more quickly can understand the beast, you know. But in order to do that, you really need to have somebody with you, because you normally are working out of a boat or a skiff, and there were very, very few divers. Jack Johnson was a diver, and there's another neat story about tell you about Jack Johnson and I, but because people would see me diving. In fact, there's a really neat picture I have of me in the boat harbor during the King Crab Festival. What we did is we caught a bunch of king crabs before the festival and put them in the boat harbor in a pot. And then at the right time during the festival, the divers would come down to the boat harbor. We'd jump in the boat harbor off the dock, and we'd dive down to the bottom, and we'd come up with king crabs.
Oh, neat.
And of course people didn't know that they were down there in a pot. And you could just go in the harbor and find king crabs, but we didn't want to take the chance that maybe they wouldn't be there.
Uh-huh.
So we guaranteed we'd be able to find them. But when I came out and swam over to the float, Governor Egan was there. And so I handed him this great big king crab, and the whoever was taking the pictures saw to it that I got a copy. And so I have a copy of myself handing a big crab to Bill Egan. But people wanted to learn how to dive. And so I explored the possibility of teaching them how to dive. Well, I found out you have to be a certified instructor. And so it took a great deal of work to get the certification. So then I became an instructor, and I started teaching local people how to dive. And a lot of them were diving already, but they'd never learned or never studied. And there were a lot of divers in Kodiak who lost their lives.
Yeah,
boy,
I
a lot of guys.
I've heard a number of stories.
I think I can name five right off the top of my head. But at any rate, one of the biggest single problems that when you're teaching students how to dive is they need equipment. And so the next logical step was from the instructor is to have a little scuba shop. Mm-hmm. So Merle and I actually started the first scuba diving shop that was ever in Kodiak, and we called it Scuba-Doo. And every year we would fly Las Vegas. About every other year, every third year, they'd have the big trade show in Las Vegas. Or we'd go to San Antonio, Texas, or Orlando, Florida. And all the scuba diving manufacturers that would manufacture scuba diving equipment, from submarines to masks, snorkels, whatever it might be, suits, would be there with exhibits. And so we would go for a week to these trade shows, and we could learn about all the recent developments in scuba gear, and the gear changed incredibly. The only regulators we had when we first started diving was two hose regulators, and every year we'd see Cousteau. We were a U.S. divers dealer, and he was chairman of the board of U.S. divers. In fact, Cousteau was the man who developed the Aqualung initially. That was kind of neat getting to know those people. But I think we operated our scuba diving business for 10 years.
Was it successful, Guy?
Well,
I don't mean in terms of monetarily, I mean in terms of response from townspeople and participation. That's what I mean.
Well, what I did was I was teaching scuba diving at the community college, and they were offering it as a fisheries course, realizing that anybody that was going to study fisheries biology, it'd be a natural to take
that.
Scuba.
Sure.
A lot of Coast Guard pilots took the course.
Uh-huh.
But in order to pass a scuba diving course, you have to go out in the ocean and dive. So in order to go in the ocean in Kodiak, you've got to have a suit, and you need all the equipment. There's no place you can go and rent it. And so,
and it isn't like scuba diving out in Florida either.
That's for sure.
You're talking cold Pacific waters.
That's for sure. And but anyhow, we started this business, and we were known all over the United States. The name was real catchy. Everybody loved the name.
Oh, well, that's all right. You can talk. I'm going to edit this anyway. Do you want me to backtrack to see where we were? I even forget where we were.
But, you know, you're talking about the Scuba-Doo business.
Oh, right, Scuba-Doo.
It would be common. You know, maybe it's midnight. It's December 10th. It's blowing 40. And it's 20 degrees out. And the phone rings. And they need a diver.
Good.
Alaska steamship is at the dock, and they need a diver.
Well,
so that's, you know, that was common.
What would they need a diver for?
Well, either they hit the bottom, they hit a rock or a reef, or there's something wrong with their bow thruster.
Okay.
But it was real common, and so I got special permission from my boss. At early years, I was about the only guy in town that could dive, and here all these commercial fishermen, I was asking them every day to do me a favor, fill out log books and turn in tag crabs. Now they call me and want me to dive on their boat and check their boat, and I say, no, I can't, you know. And
why?
So
conflict of interest, really?
But since there was no other business in town that I was competing with, or that I was taking away their business, they actually gave me permission to provide that service. But let's say I'd have a plumber come over the house, and he'd work for 45 minutes, and then he'd leave, and he'd give me a $70 bill, and then that weekend, that same plumber would come over to my dive shop,
yeah,
And he'd come in and he'd talk for an hour about where's the best place to dive and where do you recommend I dive and how should I do this and how should I do that. And he buys a couple of O-rings and he spends a dollar and he says, I'll see you later, goodbye. And here's a guy that charged me $70 an hour and I'm charging him a dollar an hour.
So he made more money.
Well, what I started thinking, I'm in the wrong business. And but we operated in our house for years, and then we moved out to a little tiny shack that we had out in the back of the house. Uh-huh. But we finally sold the business to Verlin Jarine, who was one of my students. He took my course and learned how to dive, and then in later years went to commercial diving school and came back to Kodiak. And so it's growing. It's a lot bigger now. And
so that business is still in existence?
It's still in existence, yeah.
Huh. Did you run it out of this house here? This was
the same? Uh-huh, yeah, the same house right here.
Huh.
In fact, I think we've been out of business now about 5 years.